Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Reyes, Judge Sleater. The Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 24th day of October 2019. We're ready for oral argument in the first case on the calendar in the matter of the civil commitment of Stephen, is it Hoagie or Haji?
Hoagie.
Please approach the podium and state your name for the record before you begin your argument on behalf of Mr. Hoagie.
May it please the court, counsel, attorney Carrie Doom here on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Mr. Stephen Hoagie. Mr. Hoagie is a 68-year-old man who was committed as a sexually dangerous predator back on July 23rd of 2008. He has spent the past 11 years in the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program, still at phase one at the Moose Lake facility. Mr. Hoagie petitioned initially to the Special Review Board for a discharge from his commitment. That request was ultimately denied, and he subsequently filed a request for rehearing to a Supreme Court appeal panel. That matter went before the Supreme Court appeal panel, and ultimately the panel granted the Commissioner of Human Services motion to dismiss. And that brings us to our present appeal today. This court reviews a judicial appeal panel's decision to dismiss a petition under Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure 41.02 de novo. In proceeding with his petition for discharge, the committed person may be discharged only if a judicial appeal panel determines that the committed person is capable of making an acceptable adjustment to open society, is no longer dangerous to the public, and is no longer in need of inpatient treatment and supervision. In determining whether to order the discharge, the judicial appeal panel must consider whether specific conditions exist to provide a reasonable degree of protection to the public and to assist the committed person in adjusting to the community. At a phase one hearing, the petitioner bears the burden of moving forward with evidence, which means presenting a prima facie case with competent evidence to show that the person is entitled to the requested relief.
What is the competent evidence that he presented?
Yes. In this particular case, the competent evidence that he presented really comes down to what his behaviors have been within the confined facility for the past 11 years. Here, we have to look at, when we're looking at somebody who's been in this type of situation, their past behaviors are being used to determine what that risk is moving forward. And so similarly, should their behaviors within that facility over the past 11 years. The evidence that was presented included testimony from his therapist, Ms. Berg, Wanda Berg, who testified that he engages appropriately with other residents at MSOP. She testified that she had not observed any concerning behaviors in Mr. Hoagie's interactions with other residents at MSOP. She testified that there was no history of engaging in criminal activity or sexually inappropriate activity while at MSOP. And she further testified that a review of his file did not reflect any type of boundary issues.
Counsel? The Supreme Court has indicated, and I believe this court, that in terms of determining whether or not someone still needs treatment, we need to look at what sort of treatment were they committed to receive and whether or not they still need that treatment. In other words, we need to ask, does a person have a sexual diagnosis that's in remission such that they don't need treatment anymore? So although I agree, the record indicates there have been no behavioral problems to note in the treatment facility. What evidence in the record indicates that your client's sexual diagnosis is in remission such that he doesn't need treatment?
In this particular situation, Mr. Hoagie has not been participating in a lot of treatment at Moose Lake. He did previously participate in sex offender treatment while he was incarcerated, but this is one of these situations where, and unfortunately we're seeing a lot of individuals in these situations that are not actively engaging in the group treatment. He is engaging with his individual therapist in those one-on-one sessions, but in terms of his actual treatment, he has not progressed through the treatment programming that is set forth for the expectations.
Did he present any evidence that his diagnosis is in remission such that he doesn't need treatment?
There was no evidence that was presented that he no longer needs treatment, that his diagnosis is in remission. But I also don't know that it's my understanding and looking back that a diagnosis such as his is really one that can't be in remission. It's a diagnosis that's never going to be cured. And so we have to look at whether or not he can still make that adjustment to society, even though he's going to continue to have that diagnosis. Particularly with someone with a pedophilia diagnosis, as we look forward, there's in the treatment center situation, they're never going to be able to establish that they're not going to reoffend because they don't have a population pool there to possibly offend on. And so we have to look at the other indicators about what type of behavior he's exhibiting, any type of deviant thought process to help guide that. I do acknowledge that the lack of treatment is one of the issues, but I also, in reading the statute about what governs a discharge, the requirement does not specifically state that treatment is necessary. It doesn't state that they must have gone through all of the treatment that's recommended by that is put in place at MSOP.
But it does require a consideration of whether or not he needs treatment, and his own evidence included the report of an expert saying he needs treatment.
I do recognize that, but again, as we're looking at this initial burden of production, I do think given his behaviors that he, his history, his treatment, his behaviors at the facility, the testimony that was offered at least meets us to that initial past the phase one burden of production.
But the behavior that got him there is sexually offending against children. He's not had any exposure to children in that facility. So, I mean, you're essentially asking us to say, disregard an expert's opinion that he still needs treatment for pedophilia, even though he's not been in a situation where he could demonstrate behavior that shows a need for treatment simply because he has behaved appropriately socially with his peers.
But he's never going to be able, if we look at the standard of saying...
Well, I mean, he is able to do it. He can participate in treatment. Treatment's available to him. He's choosing not to participate.
Treatment is available to him, but if we're looking at the crux question being how he's not going to be, whether or not he's going to reoffend once he is out in the population because he's not exposed to juveniles within this facility, that's always going to exist.
But the critical inquiry, or one of them under the statute, is whether or not he continues to need treatment for the disorder that was the basis for his commitment. So, I mean, you're asking us to say, well, ignore the fact that his own evidence says he needs treatment because he's well-behaved. How can we do that when the statute requires us to consider treatment and have that factor in?
And again, as I look at what the statute states here, we're looking at is no longer in need of inpatient treatment and supervision.
Well, counsel, we should stop there for a moment because that's not currently what the statute says. The current version of the statute has removed the word inpatient, and it simply says no longer needs treatment and supervision. And as I understand it, that new language took effect on May 30th, 2018, and it applies to any person committed as mentally ill and dangerous, including any pending petition for reduction in custody. So that new statute applies here. So the statute that applies refers to treatment, not inpatient treatment.
Thank you for that clarification, yes. And so again, though, as we're still looking at this from the standpoint of his initial burden of production, it's our position that there was competent evidence that was presented specifically in looking at his behaviors. And if we do look at the treatment, and even Dr. Gierach, the court-appointed examiner, did acknowledge that there had been some treatment programming that had been being done, testified that he had been that there had been previous treatment and then previously had engaged in some treatment previously. So again, I do recognize that the treatment is an impediment here, but again, the terms of the evidence that Mr. Hoagie is relying on in supporting his petition for discharge, again, rests on his behaviors. And I understand the court's concern with that.
As I see this, you're saying, well, this should be enough to get him to the second phase hearing.
Correct.
So what evidence is he going to present at the second phase hearing to indicate that he doesn't need treatment? I don't see where he's going to come up with any evidence other than what he has now. So essentially, I think if we were to rule for Mr. Hoagie in this case, we would be setting a new precedent that says you can satisfy a finding that the offender no longer needs treatment by showing that the offender has been well behaved in the program, even though he's not done treatment.
And
is that essentially what you're asking us to do?
Ultimately, what I'm asking is that the treatment should not be the sole determining factor about whether or not somebody is moved can move to forward to phase 2.
Well, it's not the sole, but the legislature has mandated that it is one of the factors.
It is. And again, my position would be is that we can look at other things in addition to that factor, and that the fact that he's not engaged in the treatment programming to the extent that MSOP staff would like to see him move through that should not preclude him from moving forward on the phase 1.
Right, but his own expert testified that he has an above average risk of recidivism. So if we look beyond the treatment, which I think is problematic in itself, there's that. And in addition to the point that Judge Larkin made, I think really the other thing that I see that he is relying on is his own testimony that he doesn't need treatment. And that's what's concerning to me, is if that is the new standard that we're going to adopt, that as long as a person says, well, I don't think I need treatment, that seems to be an easy way for any person to say, hey, I can move on to the phase 2 because I'm telling you, I don't need treatment. I think we need more than that.
And I can understand that. And I think it's looking at the two pieces together. So part of what we look at in somebody needing treatment, I would argue, is are they still engaging in behaviors within the facility that suggest that ongoing need for treatment? Are they engaging
in
criminal thinking?
Right, and I agree with you there. But here's the problem is he's engaged with adults. And he has a pedophilic disorder, so it's his engagement with children that is the concern. So the fact that he can engage appropriately with adults I don't think that carries much weight. And with the diagnosis that he has, the fact that it's not in remission and it's one that is a lifelong this disorder that he has, treatment seems to be very, very important in this case because if he is going to be eventually released, he needs to know how to treat it. He needs to know how to deal with it. He needs to know what his triggers are. And those are all things that come through from treatment. And I think that's why his own expert is concerned and says, yeah, he does need treatment to know how to deal with it. If he's in denial, that's not going to work.
And certainly, treatment can certainly be beneficial. And again, here we don't have him engaging through the full treatment that we would like to see, I'm sure that the court would like to see, in moving forward on a phase 1. Ultimately, though, again, we don't have that treatment piece here other than kind of the minimal treatment that he did participate in and the day-to-day therapy or the one-on-one therapy that he is engaging in. And his therapist did testify regarding kind of the work that he is doing in that regard. And you know, her experiences and interactions with him. And so based on that, is our position, or Mr. Hoagie's position, our position today, that he has at least met that initial burden of production. Don't have anything further unless the panel has any additional questions.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Simard? Could we get some lights on in the entry? Do you have control over that? Thank you. I don't want anybody to trip and sue us.
May it please the court. I'm Anthony Noss, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Your Honors, the Commissioner respectfully requests that this court affirm the Commitment Appeal Panel's order granting the Commissioner's motion to dismiss Mr. Hoagie's petition for discharge from civil commitment and denying his petition for discharge.
Before you get to the facts of the case, could you address for us, if you would, the change in statutory language? I appreciate that you've pointed that out to us, as well as your candor in bringing the Supreme Court's decision and call to our attention and the constitutional standard for continued commitment that it sets forth, that being inpatient treatment. Have you given any thought, or are you prepared to address, what do we make of this new legislative language in light of the fact that the Supreme Court in Call said what makes continued commitment constitutional is the need for inpatient treatment, and this court's decision in Fugelseth rejecting an argument from the state that you don't need inpatient treatment, you only need treatment, and in doing so based on, again, that Call standard of inpatient treatment. I'm a little hesitant to jump in and say, well, we're done with inpatient treatment, given the case law saying that's a constitutional mandate in terms of continued commitment requirements.
Your Honor, I am not here today, and I don't believe argued in the brief that there's a need for continued inpatient treatment despite the statutory change eliminating that word. I would say that the legal standard, the substantive legal standard here, taking the current version of the statute, which applies, that doesn't have the inpatient word, read through Call v. Gomez, is that for Mr. Hoagie to meet his initial burden of production, he has to put forth sufficient competent evidence as to one or both of the following: that he still needs treatment and supervision for a sexual disorder is one of the possible ones, and secondly, that he continues to pose a danger to the public.
Am I wrong to have concern about the constitutionality of the standard he still needs treatment when the Minnesota Supreme Court has said the standard is inpatient treatment, and this court has said that, and this court has alluded that to that again in Poole? I understand the legislature has changed the language, but we've got three cases that say you must show a need for inpatient treatment to continue commitment. It seems it would be a departure from that case law to say, well, you no longer need to show inpatient treatment. Someone can remain committed even though they don't need inpatient treatment. I'm just asking if you can give me the sort of legal analysis today that allows me to take that leap. And if you're not prepared to do so, that's fine.
Well, Your Honor, I think in Fugelseth the issue was involving a provisional discharge, and I don't think the court really needs to address that here because Mr. Hoagie is still in an inpatient setting, and that's really all that's relevant factually.
So do you mean to say that even if we were to apply sort of the old standard of need for inpatient treatment, it's your position he still failed to make his burden of production to get to a second phase hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
But
then I think we can leave that issue for another day.
So as Ms. Doom said, the de novo standard of review is what's in place here. We've already addressed then the substantive legal standard. Mr. Hoagie has failed to put forth sufficient competent evidence that he no longer needs treatment and supervision for a sexual disorder or that he no longer poses a danger to the public. In Mr. Hoagie's argument today, there was some sort of argument that his diagnosis can never be cured, apparently referring to the pedophilic disorder. Apparently Mr. Hoagie's argument is that because pedophilic disorder can never be in remission, he's got this battle he can never win, so you should just focus on his good behavior. Even if that were true, Dr. Giroc diagnosed Mr. Hoagie with two sexual disorders, pedophilic disorder and frauderistic disorder. That's clear from the testimony at pages 47 to 49 and in Dr. Giroc's report. Also, Dr. Giroc did not note either of those diagnoses as being in remission. The uncontradicted evidence, it's totally clear he has two sexual disorders. They're not in remission.
Does the record give us any indication whether or not he even acknowledges that he has those disorders?
Well, Your Honor, I don't recall if he acknowledges it. The record does reflect that he's repeatedly told providers he's not interested in attending treatment because he was wrongfully convicted and he does not want to play the game. The record is also...
I think what he testified is, it's time to move on.
That does sound familiar, Your Honor. Also, as the court seems to very clearly understand, Mr. Hoagie has not been regularly attending treatment for several years. I believe it's since 2014 or so. So the diagnoses are clear. The fact that he needs treatment related to his sexual disorders is clear. The only evidence in support of Mr. Hoagie's case is essentially that he's behaving well and that he thinks he's not dangerous.
Mr. Voss, and hypothetically, under what's the best case scenario you understand where a petitioner who wants to transfer out, is there a method of showing, how does one, when you're in the MSOP program, show other than treatment, what is the method by which one at this phase one can show that no longer a safety risk or is able to adjust in the community when one obviously isn't in the community?
Sure, Your Honor. So I think that probably the best case for a person like Mr. Hoagie to show to the commitment appeal panel in this court that he has met his initial burden would be to have testimony or documentary evidence from a risk assessor or a court-appointed examiner like Dr. Gierock saying that he no longer needs treatment and supervision in relation to the disorders that led to his commitment. And also expert testimony indicating that he's no longer a danger to the public.
And isn't that, if it's from an expert, almost always, though, necessarily going to be the result of perhaps their participation in treatment and how they went through the treatment program, acknowledgement of the offenses that led to the commitment in the first place, because they're still in the, they wouldn't know factually how they're doing in the community, obviously, but is it almost always going to be based on that treatment aspect?
Your Honor, I would assume that in a majority, again, I'm sort of speculating here, that in a majority of cases that if an examiner is going to have a good opinion of a client, that I would assume that they are participating in the program. I suppose it's possible that an examiner could find that someone is very low risk for some sort of risk assessment actuarial tool reason or something like that. But the point here, Your Honor, is that that's not what the record is here. The record is here is that Mr. Hoagie has these disorders. It's uncontradicted. The expert testimony shows that he still needs treatment and that he's still a danger to the public. This is, as the commissioner argued in her brief, it's essentially like the pool case, where this court made very clear that a committed person's own assertions that are uncorroborated and contradicted by the record don't cut it. That's not enough to meet your initial burden of production. And as it appears the court is concerned about, if this court were to do what Mr. Hoagie is asking the court to do, which is essentially to, in a way, overrule itself in the pool decision and say, well, you have some evidence that you're behaving well, you're mostly following the rules, that's enough to meet your essential burden. Well, that's inconsistent with the legal standard. He needs to show sufficient competent evidence that, if proven, would entitle him to relief. And here, that has to relate to his continued need for treatment and supervision for a sexual disorder and a danger to the public. Even if he's just behaving well, that's not enough to meet those two different prongs.
Isn't another factor that weighs against him that's going to continue to weigh against him the fact that he has these two disorders, including pedophilic disorder, that is a lifelong condition that he will never be in remission from? And how does he over, kind of similar to the question I was just asked, how does he overcome that burden? Is that also with expert testimony? Because expert testimony is always going to say he has pedophilic disorder and it's lifelong and that will never be in remission.
Your Honor, I can't really speculate as to what might be good enough down the road for Mr. Hoagie, but I think the court is, the court's question in part provides the answer that probably what Mr. Hoagie needs is some sort of expert testimony that he doesn't need treatment and supervision for that disorder.
But won't he always need treatment and supervision for that disorder?
I don't know that that's necessarily the case, Your Honor. I don't know what an expert may say, but I suppose it's possible that a court-appointed examiner may acknowledge the existence of a disorder, but opine that he has progressed in such a way that he doesn't need further treatment for it.
Well, this court has denied appeals by the commissioner when the judicial appeal panel has concluded that despite somebody's pedophilia diagnosis, they have participated in treatment in a way that assures an expert who provided testimony at the hearing that that person had the tools and skills necessary to control his or her behavior such that he or she does not present a danger to the public. So the idea that you're never cured doesn't mean you can never get out. It simply means you need to engage in treatment to get the tools to control your disorder.
Your Honor, I think the response then to both of Your Honor's questions is really that the inquiry here is not simply do you have a sexual disorder, it's do you need continued treatment and supervision for that disorder. Moving on then to the dangerousness prong, for that prong, really all there was Mr. Hoagie uttering magic words that he's not dangerous, and under the Poole decision, that's not enough, and it's contradicted by the record and uncorroborated by other testimony. So for all those reasons, Your Honors, Mr. Hoagie has failed to meet his initial burden of production. The commissioner respectfully requests that this court affirm the panel's order granting her motion to dismiss Mr. Hoagie's petition for discharge and denying his petition. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Rebuttal?
This time I don't have anything to add on rebuttal unless the panel has any specific questions.
No. Thank you both for your arguments. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within the 90 days required by law.
Thank you.